Well, greetings, greetings, and welcome. Welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the African people's struggle toward victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here in the forum, we'll examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. During the first hour of this week's broadcast, we'll bring you an exclusive interview I had earlier this week with the Haitian presidential frontrunner, former compa singer Michel Martelly. He visited the Tampa Bay area where he addressed some 200 Haitian nationals and well-wishers at the University Area Community Development Center. Also in the audience was a group of some 82 nationals who were brought to the Florida area for treatment after being severely injured from the devastating earthquake which rocked Haiti last year, January. The runoff between Mr. Martelly and former First Lady Mirlande Manigat is scheduled for next month. Well, Guyana, in the midst of Mashramani celebrations and severe flooding recently, is gearing up for its presidential elections later this year. I'll be sharing with you a conversation that I had with noted Guyanese historian Ayusi Kwayana about the political wranglings in the South American nation back in the 1960s and his views on Pan-Africanist Walter Rodney. On February 21st, this nation observed President's Day, but it seemed as though the 46th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X was hardly mentioned. We'll review that dreaded day when El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz met his demise. Now, our history is every day. So here on Caribbean Forum, we'll continue to inform and educate you, our loyal listeners. So tell someone that Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours. We are heard every Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time here on the Uhuru Radio Network. And tomorrow and every Sunday, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds from 7 until 10 p.m., also Eastern Standard Time, when we relive those easy listening and romantic songs of yesteryear from around the world. But very importantly, next weekend will be very special here on the Uhuru Radio Network. On Saturday and Sunday, March 5th and 6th, we will be conducting a telethon in an effort to raise revenue for the operation of this network and Uhuru News. Yeah, I'll be with you at a special time on Saturday, March 5th, from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. And joining me will be guests such as Chairman O'Malley Ishitela, Felicia Passard, Babacar Mbor, Ayusi Kwayana, and many others. Our Sunday broadcast, Golden Sunday Sounds, will be on Sunday, March 6th, from 7 until 9 p.m., with guests such as recording artist James Cannings and our brothers and sisters from the Bahamas. So you can log on to uhurunews.com for further information about the telethon, as we would be asking you to give as generously as you can afford, especially in these trying economic times. We'll be offering premiums of books, CDs, documentaries, memorabilia, and much, much more. We'll be back after that exclusive... We'll be back and bring you, that exclusive interview that I had with Michel Martelly, the presidential candidate.
Hold on. Hold on. Hold on.
Front runner, if I may say, of the upcoming presidential elections in Haiti. Mr. Martelly, first of all, congratulations for getting to this point in your quest to become the next president of Haiti. I'm sure you would agree with me that these elections are unprecedented. How would your leadership differ from that of your opponent, should you be successful?
First of all, I want to thank you, Ron, for having me. And to go straight to the answer, I will state that it will probably be the first time in the history of Haiti that the president will allow the first minister to govern. It will be the first time that the mayor will be in charge of the town, because we want to build a country finally. We want to build a country. We don't want to just develop Port-au-Prince as they have done before. We need to decentralize. We need clean governance. We need transparency. And I'm willing to change the situation that we're in today, to bring all these criteria so we can see results, so we can show respect to the money that's being, to the people who have been giving money to Haiti, money that we've been using, but again, we don't see where this money is being spent. So I think this is really change that we've been selling. That's a new vision for Haiti, and that's what I've been campaigning on. My opponent has mainly been talking about my inability to govern, and I don't think it's a good program.
One of the problems in the outer world is that whenever we hear about Haiti, it is always the negative aspect showing the slums. And I know for a fact that there are some pristine areas in Haiti. What would you do to change that perception that Haiti is not what we see on a regular basis?
Well, change the images that are being sent through the press. Haiti is a beautiful country. Yes, we have our problems. Yes, because of lack of good governance, we seem to be a poor country. But to me, I think Haiti is rich, rich through its culture, rich to its geographical location, rich to the fact that we have the human resources, rich to the fact that our lands are fertile and can be used to produce and exploit, export. Coffee, cacao, cocoa, and so many things. And nowadays, I think because due to a lack of leadership, we just don't do these things anymore.
Deforestation in Haiti has been devastating to that country. How could that be corrected?
Well, this is a big issue. Just this morning, I came back from Port-au-Prince. I was flying over the country, and I realized that we barely have green coverage over Haiti. But again, in my track of putting together a national force, I have often thought of putting them to work. Once we get to have that national force, we have to realize that Haiti is not a country that's going to be in a war at any time. However, these soldiers, that force could be used to do some work as far as reforestation. They could also have some knowledge as far as being comment de secouristes,
the first responders.
Okay. At time of emergencies. We need a plan for the environment. We need to mobilize our people. We need to sensibilize them, because most of the country is being ravaged,
devastated.
It's because of lack of employment and people to survive if all they have in front of them is a tree.
Speaking of unemployment, Mr. Martelli, most of the young people in Haiti who are either protesting against or supporting the return of Jean-Claude Duvalier were either not born or rather young. Is this a fair representation of what is going on in Haiti as far as the young people reacting to the return of Mr. Duvalier?
Well, the young people reacting to the return of Mr. Duvalier means simply that for the last 25 years, while Duvalier was gone, there has been nothing done for this young, for this youth. And it's a reaction. They haven't had access to education, to universities, and they've heard jobs neither, and they've heard from their parents how back in the days we had some political problems, but at least we had a state. If you had a problem, you knew where to go to. The police were not involved in drugs. The president was never involved in drugs. And nowadays, well, for the last 20 years, it's been a country ruled by corruption all over. And for this, the youth, they have decided to fight for change. And just the comparison between the Duvalier era and this era makes them feel like they just want change. It's not like they know Duvalier that much or they ever knew what it was like, but they've heard from their families.
Mr. Martelli, what does Haiti need to be a viable force, not only in the Caribbean region, but throughout the world?
Well, right now we need to rebuild our country. We have priorities everywhere and we have urgencies.
What is your estimation as to how long that will take?
Well, we need a plan
for there to be some sense of normalcy.
We need a plan for like 25 years, probably 25 years. 70 to 80% of our people are illiterate. They have no access to education. We don't have a health plan, healthcare system. We don't have jobs. And before we can even attract foreign investment, we need to change a few laws. For instance, to create an enterprise, a company in Haiti, it takes you still 105 days when you can do it 15 minutes everywhere else. So our own diaspora, our families, afraid at times of coming back home because of insecurity. Yes. So we have so many domains that we need to work on before we can make it safe. And then again, it needs to start by having the right leadership to reinforce confidence, reassure the people, bring confidence between the people and the states, between the international, the donors, the international community, and Haiti, before we can even get anywhere.
Should you be successful, what is your first problem that you would like to tackle and have eradicated?
Definitely the cholera problem and these people living under the tents. Because I've been under those tents around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not an easy thing. But as I stated before, these are urgencies. Everything else is a priority because in some places, people don't have access to cold water. People don't have access to electricity. Mm-hmm. The internet doesn't exist everywhere.
The wet foot, dry foot law has been in effect whereby Cubans who make it on the shores of Florida are given the ability to apply for asylum, whereas Haitian nationals who have made it to the shores have been almost immediately booked and returned to Haiti. Would you like to see that, or is that priority on your list as to things that you would like to see changed?
Well, definitely I'd like to see the same law for the Haitian. But first, really, my concern is to restore dignity, make of Haiti a country where its children doesn't need to live anymore, to live. Well, as a matter of fact, I want to make them feel like it's time to go back home. I want to rebuild that country where Haitians do not want to leave Haiti, but in the contrary, Haiti becomes again La Perle des Antilles that it was like 30
the
years
Pearl
ago.
The Pearl of the Caribbean.
The Pearl of the Caribbean.
What is your message to Haitian nationals living abroad?
That we are ready to work with them. They are as much as us Haitians. They've probably been looking for opportunities that they couldn't find in Haiti. We're going to make sure that they have the right to participate in the decisions of the country through elections, through voting rights, and also to participate in the reconstruction of their country.
Well, merci, monsieur.
For news, views, interviews, and thought-provoking discussions, tune in to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Yes, you are tuned into Caribbean Forum. I am Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We are here every Saturday from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time, and then we're on the air on Sundays from 7 until 10 p.m. with Golden Sunday Sounds. As I mentioned earlier, Guyana is also gearing up for its elections later on this year, and there has been a lot of political turmoil, not only in Guyana, but throughout the Caribbean. I had an in-depth chat with AUC Kwayana, who back in his day, or back in the days of the 60s and the 50s, he was known as Sidney King. And we had an in-depth talk about the political ramifications and the situation in Guyana back in the 1960s, and also his take on Pan-Africanist Walter Rodney. Here is my conversation with Brother AUC Kwayana.
It is my distinct pleasure and honor to present to some of you and reintroduce to others someone whose early works were oriented to mobilizing youth to be in the vanguard in Guyana's political future. AUC Kwayana. Brother Kwayana, welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Thank you very much, Brother.
Brother AUC Kwayana, over the years, you have been somewhat misunderstood. Could you clarify for our listening audience by telling us who AUC Kwayana is?
Oh, that's the hardest job for me. let me see. I'm an ordinary person. I'm essentially a villager.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in a sugar estate near to Buxton, and at the age of 7, I went into Buxton. I lived there for the next 78 years continuously, except for a year in New Amsterdam as a child. And that's where I am. I've never lived in any of the cities of Guyana until I had to come here. Yes.
How difficult was it for you to leave Guyana to take up residence in another country?
Well, I never left Guyana to take up residence. I left Guyana to visit my family. But the situation in the surroundings where I live degenerated, and it was thought unwise for me to go back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Physical conditions, you know, there was a lot of violence and unpleasantness, and I'm a person walking on the road. I don't even have a car or a guard in throughout my life. So,
are you speaking specifically in the Buxton area?
That's where I live.
When did you meet Walter Rodney, and under what circumstances did that occur?
I met Walter Rodney while he was in Tanzania, and he used to visit George. Of course, everybody knew his name, but he used to come to Guyana occasionally, and that was the time when our organization, the cultural organization ASCRIA, was active, and he would visit us there whenever he was in Guyana. And that's when and where I met him. After that, I met him more closely when he came back to Guyana in 1974 to join the struggle there for improvement. Anyway, he was appointed, as you know, head of the History Department by the Appointments Board, the Academic Board, and his appointment to that university was overridden or cancelled by higher authorities.
Why do you think the government had rescinded his appointment?
They have never explained it. We can only speculate.
Yes,
I would imagine that they did not like his politics. He had had some trouble in Jamaica.
Right.
You know,
yes,
he was
we'll get
a
into.
Person who went directly to the basic contradictions among the population, and the newly independent government in Jamaica did not like his emphasis on the poor and the time he spent re-educating the masses of poor people who came to his groundings. And they banned him from returning to the country after he had gone to the Black Writers' Conference in Canada. So, I don't know. Things like that, I suppose, must have disquieted the regime in Guyana.
Mm-hmm. What was it that attracted you to him, or vice versa, when you first met him in Tanzania?
I can't speak to him. We did not first meet in Tanzania.
Oh, okay.
We met in Guyana while he was in Tanzania and was visiting Guyana.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, he was a hero before he returned home, or before he did any of that, especially after his expulsion from Jamaica. And so everybody knew his name. We were following up his writings and whatever we could of his activities wherever he was. As you said in your opening, he had gone to the top of the academic ladder at a very early age, and that kind of thing does not escape Guyanese.
Absolutely. I remember growing up in Guyana, and you at one point in your life were the main attraction, if I can say that, to many Guyanese, in that you had made a stance and you had undergone a hunger strike. Could you just briefly just give us the circumstances surrounding your actions?
The circumstances were that during the 1960s, and this particularly was in 1964, there was a lot of ethnic conflict in Guyana, which I place as having started in 1961 on the night of the general elections. There was a lot of tension during the general elections, and it ended with a fatality on the quarantine. And beginning from the next year, around the budget crisis, when the TUC found a lot objectionable in the national budget and took to the streets, and there on the 16th of February 1962, there was a so-called riot in Georgetown, but the people who suffered were workers.
Mm-hmm.
Some were said to be looting and some were shot while going home. I think a police officer was also shot. I was nowhere on the streets. I had no political attachments at the time. I was said to be in the political wilderness. I was there teaching and looking on in Buxton and commenting from time to time.
Okay.
That went on to 1963. I've given my opinion on these things. I don't know if you want us to get into that, but they all had particular political reasons. The difference is that in 1961, the sufferer, he happened to be a member of the PNC and supporter of the PNC.
Okay.
The same thing happened in 1962, but this time it was the masses of workers and their supporters in the city, which was a PNC stronghold, that were objecting to the government's actions. But as I said, apart from the police officer, I think his name was McLeod or something like that, the people who suffered were either said to be looters or innocent bystanders. I knew of one case of an innocent bystander who had stopped at a major road on his bicycle and happened to be shot. In 1963, the struggles took place, again led by the TUC and their political allies and the PNC and the United Force. And some people always forget the guys, the youth movement of the United Force. I'm talking of those who were on the attack.
Okay, okay.
The PYO was on the other side.
Yes, that's correct.
They were responding to the attack because, of course, people in government do not create disorder. It is the people outside of government who usually spark disorder in order to achieve certain ends, which either which they think cannot be achieved outside of that kind of activity or in order to demonstrate something in the attitude of the government.
Mm-hmm.
In 1964, the tables turned because at the end of 1963, there was this constitutional conference in London dealing with independence. It was a time when there was a colonial secretary or secretary of state for the colonies named Sands, and Sands had visited Guyana, and he was the one in charge of this conference. And he was able to deal with the PPP, which headed the Guyana delegation, as the people in government at the time, the PNC, the main opposition, and the United Force. Those three leaders were the main persons at the conference. I'm saying all of this from the reports and the records.
Okay.
When they could not agree on a constitution, Sands apparently threw down the gauntlet to them and said there would be no independence unless they asked him to impose a solution, and he would not do it unless they asked him. So he made it clear that it would have to go back to the colonial situation we were in unless these leaders from the country asked this, you know, this dominant official of the overlord country to impose a solution, which is what they had been doing all their life since the time of the enslavement. And apparently they granted him this facility. Dr. Jagan was on the history of it, the first to sign, and he argued with Mr. Burnham and Mr. DeGar about signing. Dr. Jagan apparently had been assured by his advisors, who were English people, that Britain would never impose proportional representation.
Right.
Because it was against their system, although, of course, it was in Australia at the time, one Commonwealth country, I remember, that had it. So there was this idea in Dr. Jagan's head, I believe, that PR would never be imposed.
Mm.
But after Sands had got the so-called request from them, that is exactly what he opposed and ordered an election before the independence could be granted. This disappointed and angered Dr. Jagan, many of whose supporters felt he had acted unwisely, because it is the opposition that wanted proportional representation and not the PPP. I have written on this also. Now, the general attitude to all of this in the international field is that the Constitution was fiddled to get the PPP out of office. That is true, but it was not fiddled without the assistance of the PPP itself. The British and the Americans had their own motive for wanting the PPP out of office. The opposition parties in Guyana had their own approach to the whole situation, and they argued for proportional representation. And the British, knowing the results of the 1961 elections, knowing that the PPP vote could be overcome by a combination of the PNC vote and the United Force vote, saw right away that I'm talking of the popular vote, not the number of seats, number of constituencies. And so it was obvious that they would, if they wanted to get rid of this troublesome official, that they would use a political, an electoral system that would allow them to do that without direct physical intervention at that point.
How did Teddy Jagan's Marxist ideologies play into all of this?
You're talking of the decision to impose PR?
Yes.
The Marxist ideology, the fact that Britain and America regarded the PPP as too close to Moscow, was there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why they wanted to get him out. He was also close to Cuba. At the time, he was perhaps the only political party in Guyana that was friendly towards Cuba, and they wanted to get him out. So that is how they interpreted his ideology. I'm not approving any of that ideological stuff. That was not my problem. They got him out. I want to point out, though, that on the figures, there was a basic injustice in the electoral system, which was an injustice based on population. You see, unfortunately, after 1953 elections and the split in 1955, and Mr. Burnham and Jainrain Singh and Dr. Lachman Singh left the PPP and established another party, the PPP, which became the PNC. The voting became racial. People voted on ethnic lines, and people have not wanted to admit that.
That's where that all happened, Jatta.
I became a pariah in Guyana for saying that, you know, for pointing that out.
Yeah.
But I could not. I lived in a multi-ethnic village. I grew up in a multi-ethnic region. I could not ignore that for some sort of political posture. That was something that we would have had to deal with for the sake of the future and the younger generation. And when I pointed it out, I became the enemy, the public enemy, as if I was a British that had created this kind of division among the races. So the situation was because of the racial voting. I'm pointing to what I call an electoral injustice. The PPP could get a seat on the constituency basis, first past the post, for every 4,000 plus votes. The PNC, on the other hand, required 11,000 plus votes to get that same seat. And the GAR, the United Force, was somewhere in between, but similarly disadvantaged. So you could not talk of, in a racial, you see, when there was not a racial voting, it didn't matter. When the PPP was united, you could take it in your stride. But once things became to be defined politically on ethnic lines, this became a factor, and it is what the opposition brought forward, and what gave the British and the Americans a way out. They were not interested in solving any racial problem. They wanted a way out. The British wanted a way out. The Americans were breathing down their throat. You're going to let this second Cuba develop in the Caribbean if you allow this man to get independence and win an election. And he could win an election. You know, I disagreed with a lot of people in Guyana who are dreaming, who did not understand the dynamics of the population.
If I may ask, Mr. Kwayana, what is it that actually broke the camel's back that forced you to make that firm decision you made in going on that hunger strike?
I was coming to that. You see, most of my life was spent in a classroom, and so I don't believe in song bites. I don't want people to,
okay,
to accept my judgment without explaining it.
I appreciate that, sir.
Because this is what my students made me do. I'm not suggesting that anybody listening is my student, but I mean, I have the responsibility of explaining.
They are.
Dr. Jagan went back to Guyana, disappointed and frustrated at the way the British had handled the problem. And he promised what was called a hurricane of protest. And within that context of having to felt moved to protest against the imposition of PR and an election before the independence should come, he generated this hurricane of protest. And this was the first time that the PPP, in those years of violence, directly took a hand in what I call actual responsibility for the violence. I've said that the PPP, the PNC and the United Force and the TUC were in the forefront in 62 and 63. In 1961, it was the sort of triumphalism of PPP supporters that led to that fatality in Rose Hall. But in 1964, it was not the United Force and the PPP that wanted disturbances. Their battle was won in 1963 after Duncan Sands imposed PR. This is very key for people to understand. In 1964, it was the PPP who had a motive for disturbance. And they declared it quite openly. I mean, you remember the slogans that appeared on bridges in red along the East Coast, from going up and down. And I do not want to excite the public with them because I don't have a photograph. And you could think that I'm making claims. And I always allow for doubt. But he had placed himself in that position, and the PPP in that position. And this led to a lot of violence. This time, violence was directly on the sugar belt. And there was a lot of... You see, in 1961, 1962, there was little sign of arms among the people. In 1963, things like explosives and so on began to be used. And it was very clear that firearms were around. There were various incidents which cannot be recounted now.
Okay.
But in 1964, it was definitely an armed kind of thing. There were a lot of snipers. The Sugar Estate, through I don't know whom, organized a lot of strike breakers, because Gawu called a strike on the sugar industry. And that is what created the situation for tension and for this kind of violence, especially in the sugar belt. But it did not spare Georgetown. Georgetown was in the thick of it in 62 and 63. And in 1964, it was the sugar belt. Now, this has some logic in it. We all know who are strong in the sugar belt.
Yes.
So we began to hear reports from the west coast of Demerara. The first fatalities again took place on the quarantine, and they were labor-related. They were trade union-related. Let me say that the people who were breaking the strike on this occasion were particularly African Guyanese workers, because the Gawu at the time, and perhaps still has total control of the sugar belt, and their workers were on strike. So the people who are going to break the strike to get sugar producers going, people are going to be recruited, are ultimately supporters of the then opposition parties.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of gunfire, a lot of violence took place. It was not one-sided by any means. There was some retaliation on the West Coast. This famous case the PPP always talks about, a woman named Kausilya. There was a picket. They were picketing to keep out strike breakers from going into a sugar plantation on the West Coast of Demerara. I think it was near Nora. And a woman named Kausilya was overrun by a tractor or some kind of agricultural machine and died as a result. And that was a fatality not imposed by the PPP.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. As I mentioned, we're chatting with Ayusi Quiana. He's going to continue at the other end of this break, capsulizing exactly what led up to that stand that he made back in the early 60s in Guyana with that hunger strike in which he participated.
The focus of the violence had altered. The engine of disturbance had switched from the two opposition parties, the PNC and the United Force, to the incumbent party at the time, the PPP. And the motive for this disturbance was to prevent the PR election from taking place, because the results could be foretold quite easily. They were a foregone conclusion, as we say, because the two opposition parties, seats won by them, if put together, would overcome the number of seats won by the PPP alone. So these fatalities began to take place. The first fatalities were reported from the Skeldon area, and strike breakers again. The MPCA was on the strike breaking side because they were a union rival to the Sugar Workers Union, what we call now the GAU. I think it was still then the Guyana Industrial Workers Union. And two men were killed, one an African, one an Indian, as a result of a bomb thrown into a truck carrying strike breakers. That is how it began there. And then on the west coast of Demerara, we began to hear of muted reports. People coming across on the ferry would bring the news. Very little was in the newspapers. And we at Astra headquarters in 3rd Street received many visits by people coming across and telling us what was actually going on the ground. We made statements and so on, and they were ineffective. The violence continued, and retaliation resumed or began again, so that there were no innocents, you know.
At that point in time, you felt that these reports were being deliberately suppressed?
Well, I had no alternative. I claimed that they were being deliberately suppressed. The press perhaps had its motive. Some part of the press did not want to excite the population, you see.
Okay.
That is the kind of motive they have. But at the same time, they were suppressing the real reporting on what was going on. Each side has some merit, but if you have people who are dying, certain people in the community have to take some kind of responsibility, regardless of whether the press wants to publicize it or not. And we had enough information to know that this was correct, because political leaders began to go over there and appeal for peace and that kind of thing. And the violence continued. So we took a delegation to the governor at the time. I think it was Ralph Gray, if I'm not mistaken. And we got no proper. We demanded a state of emergency. A state of emergency should be declared, we said, which would bring people operating with arms under full scrutiny and surveillance so as to reduce the violence. You see, I've always been scared of racial violence breaking out in Guyana because I knew what it would lead to. People used to think I was exaggerating and overstating the tension and all of that, but that's where I grew up. You know, I didn't go abroad to study for 5-6 years and come back to, you know, to reacquaint myself with Guyana.
You were not the only one who was scared of the racial violence, because Walter Rodney, he identified the deep-seated racial division in Guyana as the main barrier to forward movement and progress.
Precisely, but this I'm talking about before Walter Rodney became political in Guyana.
Okay.
You know? This was the situation he had to deal with some years after.
Right, right, absolutely.
And I want to talk about that a little. So if that is explanatory enough, and so after the governor refused to cooperate, this hunger strike was decided on, and I lent myself to the purpose, sat before the governor's gate.
That was certainly a scene to remember. It is etched in my mind and in many minds of those lines every night and just watching you just go through your process. Thank you, Brother Yusi Kwayana, for just preparing us and leading us up to the reason exactly why you made that decision. Now, on June 13th, 1980, it was a dark day for many in Guyana's history. When you heard of the assassination of Walter Rodney, what was your immediate reaction and what did you do? What was your immediate reaction, and what did you do?
I had gone home to Buxton. We had had a meeting at the center, which was in Home Street at the time, South Cummingsburg, so-called Tiger Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And we had shut up, and I had gone home. And then suddenly, sometime in the night, maybe around 9:30, some comrades came, some brothers, and two brothers and sisters also came up to Buxton, to the house, and gave us this astonishing news. Made no sense whatever. We wanted to know what could have happened.
Were you suspicious of the way that he died?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it could come from only one source. I felt it had to be a regime-imposed assassination because that was the enemy. He had not come under the fear and apprehension of any other source like that of the ruling party at the time. And it could be understood because this was a new situation. We have taken a leap from 1964 to 1980. And many of the listeners must be in quite a quandary, wondering what's going on. Now, this sort of ethnic competition continued after Mr. Burnham took over as Prime Minister in 1964-65. The violence subsided. There was a lot of rehabilitation and so on. People were compensated and so forth. But the political tension remained. And when Walter Rodney decided to come back home to teach in Guyana, that is what was his object. He came to teach history at the University of Guyana. And,
that's correct.
People were very, very happy to have such a quality service added to the University of Guyana, which was doing quite well at the time also. And he was denied this opportunity by intervention from above. You know, the PNC definitely overruled and vetoed his appointment. That is no question.
Okay.
The records are there. And he was twice denied. It is twice that within that same period that he was denied this job after being appointed by the academic board at the university. So he came back and decided to stay. He looked around and he decided to join the Working People's Alliance, which had already been formed as a pressure group. So,
who was it that initiated that WPA?
Oh, a number of us initiated in this way. There was ASCRIA, an African cultural organization. ASCRIA means African Society for Cultural Relations with Independent Africa. But that is not all that we did, because we became involved in everything that went on, because first of all, you are representing the issues of African Guyanese. And when it became clear that there was some danger of their being excluded, ASCRIA was very active, and we had a lot of social programs. We ran a full school at 3rd Street. Many people tell you they went to school at ASCRIA in 3rd
Street. Yes, I remember
that. It was
an
evening school, and fees were not a barrier to education there. We got many young Africans to come and pitch in. People who had been qualified abroad would come in there and teach at night. So that was a responsibility. And Rodney came, and the focus on the WPA soon surrounded among him as the most eminent of all the figures there, and among one of the youngest too. He had such a clear view of society and the international situation, as well as history and the domestic history of Guyana, that it was easy to support him.
Hmm.
And he had no agenda. He told me once, driving with him in a car, that he would never become a full-time politician. So all the people who thought he wanted to become president are quite wrong. Walter Rodney was aiming at helping to clean up the situation and then pursue his academic work while being active. He was a political animal.
Mm.
He did not look forward to being prime minister, president, or anything like that. He could not stand the gyrations of the political life, you know.
Apart from what many of us have read and studied about Walter Rodney, in your words, what was his personal life like? Was he always intense?
I have a problem here.
Okay.
Because we are not from the same generation.
Okay.
I was born in 1925, he was born in 1942.
That's correct.
I cannot speak at first hand about his youth, his school days and all of that.
Okay.
There are others who can, but I cannot. I've heard a lot of that from people and since I came to know him and his family, but okay. I cannot speak at first hand about that. But from the time I knew him, he was young and at the same time mature, especially in judgment. He was...
Mm.
He had a very interesting method of coming to a conclusion, you know. And people whom I've encountered in the United States of America here from the liberation movement of the United States of America have said the same thing. He would meet with them and ground with them and go through with them the contradictions on the spot here, where race was important, where class played a part and all of that, you know. And they value him to this day for that kind of perception. He had a remarkable logic and a remarkable perception. What I find most, I'm going to come back to more practical political things soon. What I found a lasting contribution to his theories is the issue of class formation. He did not only see the classes in a dead sense, as some people do. You have this working class, you have a dominant class, you have the bourgeoisie, you have a middle class. He saw the situation as dynamic, in which people were continually moving from one stratum of or subclass of the population into another, and they after that change their outlook or change their mentality. And one of his great sermons was that people, he called himself a member of the petty bourgeoisie, a member of the educated middle class. He did not pretend to be a worker. He said he had become that. But the way he solved it was that his service was meaningless unless it was devoted to the mass of working people,
yes,
who were history. So that was very, very distinctive about him.
Since his death, Mr. Kwayana, the WPA did not seem to have a strong hold politically in Guyana. Why was that so?
That is not accurate.
Okay.
Since his death, of course, the WPA went through a period of almost paralysis, you know.
Right.
As any human organization would.
Losing an effective leader.
Yes. And he was not leader officially. He was the popular leader.
Okay.
You see, people had chosen him as leader. We had a collective leadership in which we would circulate who would chair the collective from time to time, you see, before and after we became an actual political party. But, and Walter Rodney did a lot of education. And while running this political agitation against the growing dictatorship. He was also writing the history of the working people of Guyana. He used to ask me whenever I went out into the countryside to interview older people. And I used to do that and bring back the notes for him, and he would do a lot of it himself. Many people will tell you Walter Rodney slept in their house, you know, gathering this kind of information.
But before I let you go, sir, if I may ask you, were Walter Rodney alive today, what do you think his reaction would be to what's happening in places like Darfur, Venezuela under Hugo Chavez's rule, Latin America, Haiti, etc.?
I don't think he would have had many problems with Venezuela or Haiti or generally. Darfur is a bit of a problem for the Africans because what they are fighting over there is not the fact that massacres and deaths are taking place. Everybody agrees that there's massacres, there's death, there's a lot of crimes against humanity. But they're fighting over the definition of genocide. Whether or not it is genocide, it appears from what I've been studying that genocide must directly involve the state, and the state must aim at the removal or destruction of a particular ethnic group of the population. And they are arguing about that because the ethnic problem is so complicated, according to some descriptions, even of African leaders, you know. But I think that is a distraction. The point is that people are being destroyed.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And it needs a human international response, because to sit idly by and hear more and more of the same every day is not righteous.
It certainly isn't, certainly isn't. But I'd just like to share with you and the listening audience a poem that was written by James Richmond, and it was dedicated to Walter Rodney, and it goes, Walter, you're dead. Stay dead now. And the dangerous late 70s and the early 80s fly and close the masses' eyes. Dear man, live in buried truths, in the streets of the people where true revolution lies. Banditry and the neglected platform of interracial cohabitation optimized, where the Rodneyite dies, squandered fruits of misguided youth, fools taught lies, ignorance suffice and rise, still it rise, still it rise. Come revolution, come, come revolution, come, I am revolution, son, Rodney the champion, Rodney the revolution. Speak, Walter, of how we underdeveloped ourselves, speak emphatically of yourself. We want another revolution. Oh, let the groundings of knowledge gain at your sacred shelves. Tell the story of revolution and of the possibilities in themselves. Where lingering essence of marvelous light dwells. To this inherent depth we must find the solution. Wreaking havoc at our soul, come, dispel. A day of reckoning must compel an upward rise. Let us rise, let us rise. Come revolution, come, come revolution, come. I am revolution, son. Rodney the champion, Rodney the revolution.
Wonderful. It is very exciting that poetry like that is being written. Today I read a poem of Martin Carter to a small audience here on Walter Rodney, Assassins of Conversation. Anyway,
yes,
thank you.
Yes, yes.
And may his works bear fruit.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Stag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the Fort from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There won't be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
This is Carib World News in Brief. I'm Ken Webb. Grammy-winning reggae singer Buju Banton could be jailed for life. Singer Wyclef Jean has thrown his support to sweet Mickey Martelli. And Beyonce, Rihanna, and Usher, they're talking about him. Grammy-winning reggae singer Buju Banton could be jailed for life. Banton, 37, whose real name is Mark Myrie, was found guilty of three cocaine-related charges Tuesday by a Florida jury. They included conspiracy to possess with an intent to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine. He was, however, found not guilty for knowingly and intentionally possessing a firearm. The trial, which began on February 14th, was the second attempt of the U.S. government to convict the Jamaican artist. A first trial last year was declared a mistrial after jurors failed to arrive at a unanimous decision. Buju was arrested on December 10, 2009, and released on bail almost a year later. Throughout the trial, the singer maintained his innocence. No sentencing date has been set. Haitian-born hip-hop singer Wyclef Jean has thrown his support to Compa singer Sweet Mickey Martelli. As campaigning in Haiti kicked off officially, Jean threw his support behind fellow musician Mikel Sweet Mickey Martelli. Martelli, 49, will face off against former First Lady Merlan Manigat for the post. The runoff comes after a chaotic November 28th first-round vote triggered fraud allegations and street protests. Martelli has managed to sway young voters who were disappointed after Jean failed to get on the November ballot. Manigat, 70, was the top vote winner in the first round, but failed to garner more than 50% to win the election outright. Singer Mariah Carey has found herself in the middle of the Liberian debacle. Diplomatic cables revealed by WikiLeaks have reported that Liberian leader Muammar Gaddafi's son paid Mariah Carey $1 million for a performance. As quoted in the New York Times, the leaked documents report that the singer was paid by Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi to sing 4 songs at his New Year's party on the Caribbean island of St. Barts. The cables also note that Gaddafi's son, Muat Asim, Libya's security advisor, also held a star-studded New Year's party in 2010 and invited Beyonce and Usher to perform. The disclosure, which forms part of a series of observations on the lavish lifestyle of the Gaddafi family, comes on the heels of violent crackdowns by Gaddafi on protesters in Libya. This is Carib World News in Brief. I'm Ken Webb. On the ET scene, sexy Bayesian singer has aroused the Donald. Donald Trump says the sexy Grammy-winning Bayesian singer insulted him after canceling on a performance at a benefit he had hired her for. Trump claims that Rihanna says she was sick and could not perform at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute fundraiser in Florida. But then she ended up singing over the weekend at an NBA halftime show. Guests at the cancer fundraiser had paid up to $120,000 for a table to see the singer perform over the weekend. Organizers ended up hiring Dreamgirls star Jennifer Hudson, as Trump insisted that Hudson's voice is better than Rihanna's anyway. Rihanna, through her representative, said that she was sick, and her doctor advised her not to get on a plane and perform. And in sports, West Indies opened their ICC Cricket World Cup 2011 on the losing end as they succumbed to South Africa by 7 wickets on Thursday night at their Faraz Shah Kotla Stadium. The Windies were outplayed at the Proteas. A.B. de Villiers hit a superb unbeaten 107 as South Africa easily reached 223 for 3, all 42.5 overs, to win with more than 7 overs to spare. De Villiers played shots to all parts of the field and hit 8 boundaries and 2 sixes off 105 balls to seal the victory. West Indies will play their next Group B match against the Netherlands at the same venue on Monday. That's this week's Carib World News and Brief.
I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
Yes, welcome back to Caribbean Forum. It's now a couple of minutes after the top of the hour. Well, if today is your birthday, happy birthday to you. I must shout out my own daughter, Janelle Bob Semple, who celebrated her birthday yesterday. And today, my mother, Christabel Beatrice Bob Semple, would have been 98 years old. She made her transition in 2004, and we still remember her, of course. Happy birthday, and if you're celebrating yours, happy birthday. You're celebrating it along with Erica Badu, who is 39 years old today.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
I know it's a bit early somewhere in this land, and I know you would like to celebrate your birthday in a rather festive mood. Here is Byron Lee and the Dragon.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. How old are you now?
You are enjoying your day, all of those of you celebrating birthday today. Yes, I know you're in a good mood. Also, happy birthday is coming up tomorrow to Mr. Hicks. They're also celebrating an anniversary, or a few days ago, the 41st anniversary of the Republic of Guyana. As I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, there was a lot of rain, a lot of flooding in Guyana, but that did not stop the Mashomani celebrations. Here is Mr. John Gripal, better known as Slingshot, making his contribution to Mash Fever.
When Christmas celebration done, darling, Mashomani fever spreading all over. Tassa and Calypso music playing non-stop from January to December. Whenever I hear Mashomani music, my whole body just cannot stand still. Oh, oh. Masquerade and Kumpa music, so rhythmic, from Union Quarantine, Wisma and Sand Hill. Hey! Let me jump. Jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump.
Come with me, let me jump up for Mash from Money. Spreading Mash Fever till the sun go down. All through the land, one big festivity. Slate shot Mash Fever, hey, catching all around. With Mash Fever, all through the night, Lord, we making sweet mass. Juve morning break,
jump,
everybody they jamming together.
Jump.
Make no mistake, Mash Fever will last. Oh, oh.
Jump
to the left with Mash Fever,
jump
to the right with Mash Fever,
jump
your best with Mash Fever.
Jump,
let me jump, let me jump, let me jump. Hey.
Jump
to the left with Mash Fever,
jump
to the right with Mash Fever,
jump
your best with Mash Fever.
Jump,
let me jump, let me jump. Hey. To make Guyanese people wherever you meet, come together for this cultural fusion. Mashomani is one big family. Hey, let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump, jump.
Let me jump, jump, jump with Mash Fever.
Jump, jump, jump.
We got jump and wine. With Mash Fever,
jump,
let me jump, let me jump, let me jump. Hey!
Jump
to the left with Mash Fever,
jump
to the right with Mash Fever,
jump
your best with Mash Fever,
jump,
let me jump, let me jump. Hey!
Yes, yes, jump, 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 jump. Jump with Mash Fever, that's John Drapal, better known as Slingshot. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. And here's a 2011 oddity. This year we will experience four unusual dates. 1-1-11, 1-11-11. 11-1-11 and 11-11-11. Now take the last two digits of the year you were born, plus the age you will be this year, and it will be equal to 111. Take the last two digits of the year you were born plus the age you will be this year, and it will equal 111. Whew. Much fever going on in Guyana and then throughout the Caribbean. There's Carnival in Trinidad, but there's also some serious issues to be dealt with in the Caribbean and throughout the world, because we know that things seem to be askew. The equilibrium of this world, the floods, the situation that's going on there in the Middle East, and of course that has affected the oil and gas prices, and a lot of us are feeling the pinch. And there is need for change. There's need for change in this world, and there's also need for change in Guyana, as their elections are coming up later on this year. And here is Mr. Wayne Ford, a citizen of Guyana, a citizen of the world, a Guyanese abroad, who has his take and who is appealing to fellow Guyanese as to how we can change the situation in Guyana, the change we must embrace.
On November 18, 1978... our nation experienced instant world infamy on a day that will go down as one of the darkest days in our recent history. The murder-suicide of the People's Temple Agricultural Project in Jonestown shattered the national image of Guyana, and as Bob Marley would say, utterly destroyed. Guyana then became synonymous with Jim Jones. And over the years, our national image has been eroded even further and destroyed in many other ways. As the poorest nation in South America, it is estimated that 34% of the population of Guyana live below the poverty line, and 19% live in abject poverty. The nation of Guyana needs a new, effective poverty reduction strategy, one that works and is implementable, one that is measurable in its effectiveness. The existing strategies have failed the Guyanese people. And here are some sad examples of failed policies and strategies. In Region 1, the location of the mortuary at Port Kaituma is inappropriate, since runoff waste can get into drinking water. There's a lack of proper facility to preserve the dead. There's a lack of a library for students. Teacher absenteeism and reporting to work under the influence. The lack of portable water. The lack of telephone communication sets at police outposts. The lack of solid waste disposal facility in Region 3. High cost of electricity. Poor quality of drugs. Discrimination in health services provisions. Malnourished children with medical needs. And the list of deficiencies and inadequacies goes on for pages and pages. Distressing and sad. But poverty leads to crime. Other activities, including school dropouts and social ills like domestic violence and murders. The lack of opportunity, poverty, unemployment, human rights violations, and racial discrimination have led to the continued exodus of Guyanese to foreign soil. And Guyana has the highest rate of skilled immigration in the region. It is estimated that over 9,000 Guyanese leave Guyana annually, and we lack, therefore, the human capital necessary for rebuilding our nation. On June 1, 2009, Barbados enacted an amnesty provision targeting Guyanese who are seeking employment and residency in Barbados. A report from the Council of Hemispheric Affairs, Washington, D.C. states, and I quote, "For a number of years, a struggling economy and persisting racial tensions in Guyana has led to existing job loss, decreased standard of living, and continuous uncertainty in the minds of the Guyanese population." It goes on to say that thousands of restless and desperate Guyanese have made their way to Barbados. Many Guyanese are either deported or are facing deportation from Barbados. This is also true in other parts of the Caribbean and the world. It is said that Barbados officials were charged with designating specific benches at the airport for Guyanese in order to single out illegal Guyanese refugees. This is shameful. And as you're aware, Guyana was once considered the breadbasket of the Caribbean, to which Barbadians, Jamaicans, and others in the region flocked seeking employment and a better way of life. The rule has now been reversed after 44 years of independence and two dominant political parties. There has to be restoration of our national image through a workable poverty reduction strategy and a new effective economic development strategy, along with a revised executable national development strategy. We must create diversification of the economy through manufacturing and other means. We must export more than we import. And there must be more private sector and public sector involvement in the restoration of our nation. We must decrease our dependency on just 13 commodity products and 15 non-traditional agricultural products and create new industries. But we must go even further to restore our image in the international arena. Our educational system, which was greatly admired during the 60s and 70s, is in need of vital reform and funding. Today, our quality of education is poor and substandard. And United Nations reports indicate that one-third of children who complete sixth grade lack basic literary skills. Secondary school attendance stands at only 69%. We need comprehensive education reform. No nation can progress when its youth lack proper education. Our nation cannot progress and prosper when 87% of the University of Guyana graduates leave the country or can't find work. Guyana has one of the highest rates of skill immigration in the world. We're also one of the greatest recipients of remittances relative to GDP in the region. Remittances that account for close to 23% of our gross domestic product. The future of our nation rests squarely on the strength and education of our youth. And as Whitney Houston said, I believe the children are the future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside and give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Yet, one-third of our children under the age of five are seriously malnourished, according to UNICEF reports. And HIV/AIDS has left over 7,000 children orphaned in Guyana. How many orphanages currently exist? Once again, the nation tops the list when it comes to child labor. Child labor in Guyana sits at 16%, and that is the highest in the Caribbean. What will our future be? My friends and concerned Guyanese, in Guyana, the rates of infant and child mortality are more than double the average of Latin America and the Caribbean. And according to the World Health Organization reports, we must change direction when it comes to that area. And we must chart a new course and move in a different direction with reforms of our healthcare system. Our nation is endowed with many natural resources: bauxite, gold, diamonds, fertile lands, large tropical forests, bountiful rivers and streams. Yet our beloved nation remains a highly impoverished country where helpless and innocent children are homeless, starving, and dying. Why? Guyana is the third poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Why? We lack effective leadership. We need visionary leadership and new governance. Fresh faces, new names with bold, innovative thinkers and new blood in leadership capacities. We need change we can embrace. And as we search for new visionary leadership with innovative solutions for relief, recovery, and reform for our nation today, it is important to outline the gravity of this crisis in real terms. And I would add, but the solutions are not simple, neither are they one-dimensional. These problems are complex, pervasive, spanning every sector of the economic landscape and every strata of society. But the solutions require the brain thrust, involvement, and inclusion of all Guyanese, those in Guyana and those living abroad, if we are to move our nation forward in a positive, progressive direction for change we can embrace. And as we brace for elections in 2011, The majority of Guyanese are seeking innovative solutions for relief, recovery, and reform. It's important for Guyanese in Guyana and around the world to raise their consciousness and their awareness of the state of affairs of our nation today. We must reverse the historic levels of inequality, recurrent economic crisis, arrogant power, and resistance by the existing regime. We know we need change and enlightened hope for change we can embrace.
That was Guyanese National Wayne Ford. Opinions expressed by guests on this broadcast are not necessarily those of this host or the Uhuru Radio Network.
This is Alan Bomar Jones. The Uhuru Radio Network has news and culture direct from Africa, the Caribbean, and wherever Africans are working, playing, and fighting to be free. Support it today.
Hi, I'm Felicia Prasad, and I encourage you to support the Uhuru Radio Network because it's independent, it's community, and it's pro-black.
Get your news, views, and interviews which affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals by tuning into the Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
Yes, I know your radio is on because you are listening. And welcome to Caribbean Forum, heard every Saturday from 9 until 11. And we celebrate our history every day. And February has been noted to be Black History Month, African History Month, even though it's the shortest month of the year. And if those of you, those of you in the Tampa Bay area, if you are looking for some edutainment this evening, Saturday the 26th, I will be appearing at the studio at 6:20 with the spirit of Marcus Garvey, Looking Back, Moving Forward, the spirit of Garvey. And the studio at 6:20 is located at 620 First Avenue South in St. Petersburg. And for further information, you can call 727-895-6620. If you need to make some reservations this evening, Saturday the 26th at 8 p.m., Looking Back, Moving Forward, the spirit of Marcus Garvey, featuring yours truly. On February 21st, 1965, most of the world was stunned when we learned of the assassination of Malcolm X. His 46th anniversary was observed earlier this week, and we're going to review that day and the surroundings there at the Audubon Ballroom in New York City. Here is Like It Is host, Gil Noble.
Malcolm X was kept under heavy FBI surveillance since he got out of prison back in 1953. As he rose to national prominence as the Black Muslims' chief spokesman, he became aware that he was under close watch.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents, in uniform and out of uniform.
That surveillance escalated into the infiltration of the Nation of Islam. Personal frailties were played upon, jealousy arose, and Malcolm was ultimately ousted from that organization. This caused an intense climate of rivalry that set the stage for Malcolm's assassination in February of 1965.
He was really declared a hypocrite at the time. And because of some of the things that he was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may God be pleased with him, a strong position was really taken against him. The ministers began to speak out against the things that Malcolm was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, accusations that he had made about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He had accused the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for instance, of fathering children, and et cetera. And you must understand that at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to the Muslims then, was held in such high reverence as you would even think of any prophet being held in high reverence. And this is the kind of love and admiration that the Muslims at that time had for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when Minister Malcolm began to say those things, it was taken as an outright lie. I would say that, take for instance, one time in the Muhammad Speaks at that time, the newspaper printed a big article concerning the chief hypocrite. And it actually had a picture of Malcolm's head, you know, rolling or bouncing down the street at that time. And, you know, the way that picture is depicted, you know, he has little horns on his head and things like this here. So indirectly, I would say that a very, very strong position was taken against him.
Yes, he's immoral. You can't take nine teenage women and seduce them and give them babies and not tell me you're moral, and then tell me you're moral. You could do it if you admitted you did it and admitted that the babies were yours. I'd shake your hand and call you a man. A good one, too. But anytime you seduce teenage girls and make them be charged with adultery, make them hide your crime, why, you're not even a man, much less a divine man. So, and this is what he did. He took at least nine that we know about. And I'm not speculating, because he told this to me himself. Yes, that's why he wanted me dead, because he knew that as soon as I woke up, I'd tell it.
Plan of action was basically what took place. Me and Leon, we took seats down in the front of the Audubon, became early. We would drift into the Audubon. If indeed there was a search, then we could never enter. There was no search, so we drifted in just like we had hoped to. Leon Davis and myself took seats down front on the left-hand side. Benjamin and William, who carried the sort of shotgun, sat right behind us, you know. And Wilbur sat somewhat in the back, or almost in the middle. And our plan was, as soon as brother came out to speak, that Wilbur would throw the smoke bomb to make a distraction, and that William would fire his shotgun, and that Leon and myself, we would fire our weapons, and then this break for the door.
And without any further ado, I bring before you the Minister Malcolm, and I pray that you and I will listen, hear, and understand. Thank you.
Salaam alaikum. Hold it.
As in Dr. King's assassination, a police superior has trouble with the truth. He tells reporters that two suspects were arrested at the Audubon. Later, official police reports say that one was arrested. Also, listen closely as the police official carefully handles the question about police on the scene.
We have two suspects in custody now.
Where were they arrested? Who fired the shot?
I wouldn't know that at this time.
Where were they arrested, sir?
One of these men was arrested on the street by one of our patrolmen close by.
There were no police at this meeting, were there, Inspector?
There were no uniformed policemen assigned inside this ballroom.
No uniform police on the scene. Does this mean that police out of uniform were there? And if so, why didn't they take action? What were they doing there? This behavior pattern rings a bell of striking similarity with the behavior pattern of the CIA overseas.
The church committee produced cables, demanded and got cables, which proved it traced the CIA's plan to kill Lumumba. Sid Gottlieb got on a plane and went to Leopoldville. Headquarters sent a cable saying, use the poison. Gottlieb was couriering for the poison. Headquarters sent a cable saying, you have to use it promptly because it deteriorates. And they had a plan to try and get it into his toothpaste or give it to him in a Mickey at some social function. And then there's a gap, and no cables, no explanation of what happened. Then 5 weeks later, he's beaten to death on an airplane. And unfortunately, though, the airplane was in the control of people who had agency cryptonyms. And the gap of what happened has never been answered. The men who were involved and were responsible obviously aren't speaking out, and there's no paper to prove anything.
So perhaps the same tactics were used against the civil rights movement. Heavy infiltration of the ranks, spread the seeds of dissension, then step back and let the blood spill.
As I see it, Mr. Chairman, it is for this committee to be able to figure out how to persuade the people of this country that indeed it did go on, and how shall we ensure that it never happen again. But it will happen repeatedly unless we can bring ourselves to understand and accept that it did go on. And I say that as one who worked as a United States attorney with the Bureau and have enormous respect for its capacities in the field of kidnapping, bank robbery, and a lot of other things, but am appalled to learn what the, if it's correct, the intelligence side of that Bureau was up to for so long.
If we would like to believe that the FBI would do all this viciousness and all of these things to an individual and would stop short of killing him, then we're out of our mind. In America today, if we believe the CIA would deal with foreign assassinations and would not consider it at home, that's like saying the mafia runs crooked gambling tables in South America, but honest ones in America. It just ain't true.
We've seen then how the decade of struggle ended. Many of the prominent figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated amidst an intense climate of hatred that government agencies were acutely aware of. In fact, the FBI contributed to creating the climate of hate. Moreover, the assassinations themselves appear to have been facilitated by an elaborate network of government and police agencies who were watching very closely every move that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were making, and then at the same time, they disappeared just as the assassinations occurred. But those were the leaders. What about the students, the troops of the movement? Well, they too were subjected to harassment. This document that you're looking at now shows how the FBI tried to divide factions within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black Panther Party was also subjected to heavy, heavy surveillance.
We knew the history of the FBI's infiltration tactics in other organizations, particularly the American Communist Party. There was already a record compiled that showed that the FBI was even in charge of various branches of the Communist Party. So we understood that police tactic of infiltration.
This is the voice of ex-FBI informant Dr. Perry.
In a sense, the white racism was its own victim. Like, for racist reasons, J. Edgar Hoover had not recruited black agents. He had a lot of white agents. And it takes time to train some black agents. In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because the Black Panther Party did not have any white members, okay? And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more, put it that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly fill that gap, but it took him about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there. Usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such. In other words, the week was dated. So-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seale's, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pangs of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them this way. First off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
You also were active in the infiltration of many cultural groups. Before we go into that step by step, how
much research and study did the FBI engage in of black culture in the late 60s?
A great amount.
Give me an idea.
From the thing is, I can, they have a file on every type of magazine that blacks read. They have a file on the music.
Music?
Music, dance, theater, actors, comedians, you name it, man.
And they would actually study these different...
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
What would they do with music?
To understand the people, you have to understand the culture. To infiltrate, you have to understand. You had a lot of so-called white liberals that were infiltrating the so-called black groups using the information that they had gathered from the studies of blacks.
You mean just to understand the behavior pattern of our people?
Oh, yeah. I can, you know, Will Heaton could name out some jams of Miles Davis that I hadn't even heard of. He could name off some books that I hadn't even read pertaining to black culture.
Do you ever see agents actually studying the music of...
Yes, yes. Yes, I've seen them going over even video portion of cultural events. The understanding, like when... Okay, you have an organization like Leroy Jones Black House. You remember that. Okay, Leroy Jones's place, which was done on the thing of tribalism. I that's where I first heard the word Kintu, Mantu, Huntu, Hintu. These words of the African continuum. I learned that from an agent. He ran it down to me. They make in-depth studies of the personalities of the people they're dealing with too. Culturally, it always helps when you. It's the thing of. You can take their culture and use it against them.
How large would you say an extensive a collection on our culture would you say the FBI has? Would you rate it as large as a particular library, like the Schomburg Library in Harlem? Or
I would rate it better. I would rate it better, and the fact is that they go into details, details that we probably would overlook. Will Heaton used to meet me in different places. You know, Will Heaton, that was one of my supervising agents. There is a certain bar in the Los Angeles area where people into black cultural things met. And Will Heaton used to meet me there. And he would go into very long and tiring conversations with some very articulate brothers about culture, African culture, and Afro-American culture.
Tell me about some of the cultural organizations that you infiltrated and what you did.
PASLA, Mafunde, Watts Writers Workshop, which they had...
The Watts Writers Workshop?
Yes. Watts Writers Workshop, which was one of the oldest established black writers' workshop.
That place was burned down.
Yeah. The bureau had it burnt down.
How do you know that?
I know because I participated. I did the arson.
You burned down the Watts Writers?
Yes.
Why did they want it to go?
At the time, funding had been cut to the workshop, had been cut out, but it looked like there was a possibility of a grant being given back to the workshop. And if there was no theater, there would be no grant.
How did you do it?
Two cans of kerosene, a Purex bottle, gasoline, and a flare, highway flare.
Why didn't you use more sophisticated stuff?
Oh, no. No. You're never overly sophisticated. It's too obvious. This way you make it look like, you know, maybe somebody in the neighborhood that got kicked out of theater at one time got mad and came and burned the damn theater up, that kind of thing.
But you were involved in this theater? I mean, didn't get to you at all what you were...
Hey, man, that got to me a great deal. I love that theater. I built the stage.
You built the stage?
Oh, yeah. When I got to the workshop, the stage that had been... The original stage that had been built needed an extension on it. The original part of the stage was in terrible condition. They had no lighting system. I put the lighting system in myself. I put the stage in myself. And that was a stage, man. And that was a theater. It's a nice theater.
Who was the director of that workshop?
Harry Dolan.
Harry Dolan. Some very, very well-known artists supported that workshop, gave money to it.
Some very well-known artists came out of the Watts Writers Workshop. You know, Glenn Tubman, Yaphet Kotto, Sidney Poitier used to come down there and give a class. Sammy Davis Jr. used to come down there all the time. Quincy Jones used to come there and give music classes. We had our own 8-track studio set up for sound. We had our own sound room there.
Was part of your other activities and responsibilities to study the profiles of celebrities who were supportive of organizations?
Definitely, and especially, like I said, psychological backgrounds, weaknesses and strengths. Did he have a weakness for blondes? Did he have a weakness for money? Did he snort cocaine? Did he smoke marijuana? They even get into, and that was one thing the Bureau loves, is their sexual background. They have files and files on different blacks, not only celebrities, but a lot of others, sexual activity.
What would they do with this information?
Oh, that's used as a weakness.
So they would feed these to these weaknesses?
Yes.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. Doc Holliday, who is one of the leaders of the BGF, Black Gorilla Family, which is a prison gang in the California state prison system. Upon his release from prison, a certain sister made herself known to him at a nightclub, whereupon he moved in with her, and she picked up names, telephone numbers, information, you know, that kind of thing. That lasted for a good 3.5 months.
Was this an unusual thing, or did this happen often?
No, that happens all the time.
Did you yourself get involved in doing that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
There was a gentleman that was on trial in Los Angeles that belonged to the BLA that had been busted in a southern state for a bank robbery, but was brought with two other people to Los Angeles to stand trial for the machine gunning of a police officer in Los Angeles. I was supposed to worm my way into the affections of his sister and whatever it took to get the information that I needed as far as what kind of defense they planned to use as to turn this information over to the federal prosecution.
Did you do it?
I got the information, and thank God I didn't have to go through with the actual thing of sexual activity.
What do you mean, thank God?
The sister was rather unappealing.
You've been listening to a COINTEL documentary, which is narrated there by Gil Noble, the host of Like It Is. As we are observing the 46th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, of course, Malcolm X's father was a Garveyite, and some of his, I'm sure, ideologies and philosophies did filter through the mind of Malcolm X. At Malcolm X's funeral, the eulogy was delivered by Ossie Davis. We'll take you back to that moment.
The assassination of Malcolm X was an unfortunate tragedy. And it reveals that there are still numerous people in our nation who have degenerated to the point of expressing dissent through murder, and we haven't learned to disagree without being violently disagreeable.
Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. I say the word again as he would want me to, Afro-American. Afro-American Malcolm. Malcolm had stopped being Negro years ago. It had become too small, too puny, too weak a word for him. Malcolm was bigger than that. Malcolm had become an Afro-American, and he wanted so desperately that we, that all his people, would become Afro-Americans too. There are those who still consider it their duty, as friends of the Negro people, to tell us to revile him, to flee even from the presence of his memory, to save ourselves by writing him out of the history of our turbulent times. And we will smile. They will say that he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist, who can only bring evil to the cause for which you struggle. And we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him?
You haven't done the right thing.
Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people, and in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. However much we may have differed with him or with each other about him and his value as a man, let his going from us serve only to bring us together now. Consigning these mortal remains to earth, the common mother of all, secure in the knowledge that what we place in the ground is no more now a man, but a seed, which after the winter of our discontent will come forth again to meet us, and we shall know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our own black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, with unbearable sorrow, and to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, and to love hear and chase from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreached. unreachable star. This is not where to follow that star. Ooh, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march, march into hell for that heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my and calm when I'm late to my rest, and the world will be better for this. Oh, that one man scorned and covered with scars, ounce of courage to reach the unreachable.
Unmistakable voice of Mr. Luther Vandross, The Impossible Dream. Thank you for listening to Caribbean Forum this week. I would like to thank Mr. Michel Martelly, the presidential hopeful for Haiti, also Mr. Ayusi Quayana and Mr. Wayne Ford, and I'd like to send out best wishes to Mr. Oscar Naidu, who is a bit under the weather. I visited with him a few days ago in Kissimmee. Yes, I know you do have many rivers to cross, Mr. Naidu. All the best to you and your beloved family. Watch your thoughts. They become words. Watch your words. They become actions. Watch your actions. They become habits. Watch your habits. They become character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. If it is to be, it is up to me. We'll see you tomorrow, Sunday, on Golden Sunday Sounds at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Stay strong and be aware. I'm Ron Bob Semple.
Washed up for years, and I merely survive because of my drag to be on your own. My woman left.